teardrops are dried. No more walking the floor with that burning inside. Just to think it could be, time has opened the door, and at last I am free. I don't hurt anymore. No use to deny, I wanted to die the day you said we were through. But now that I find you're out of my mind, I can't believe that it's true. I've forgotten somehow that I cared so before, and it's wonderful now. I don't hurt anymore. To deny, I wanted to die the day you said we were through. But now that I find you're out of my mind, I can't believe that it's true. I've forgotten somehow that I cared so before. It's wonderful now. I don't hurt anymore.
You must figure I'm a real dangerous man.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
But you can find it right here on the Shooting Bench. Coming up next.
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall.
You need the Shooting Bench.
We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline.
And I am sick of the lies and the deceit and the intrusions on my privacy and the invasion of my home. And we do not intend to take this lying down.
I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way.
And now, if you think you're ready, the Shooting Bench. All right, we made it. And Eddie, I endured some of that. I turned it way down for most of it. I didn't endure as much of it as you would have hoped I would have. But anyway... For you good, oh, by the way, welcome to the Shooting Bench. It's the 9th, no it's not, it's the 29th of the 9th, 29th of September, and it's a Tuesday. And I got some stuff here that might be interesting to you here. We'll see what happens here in a little bit. But anyway, there's, let me look here. I think that... if you're planning on going by Rights at Risk's house on the way by, it's not impossible. It's just a little ways out of the way. you're going to have to take a different route. It's not. It's probably going to add, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours onto your trip, but it is possible to go by there, and it's worth going by there. She's a great gal. We tried to make it by there. The last two times I went to Washington, I didn't because it is so far out of the way, but we usually try to find a way to swing by and visit with her, even if it's just for a few minutes. But, okay, let's see here. Let me check in the chat room and see what's going on. And, wow, you guys swooping right along here. We got, oh, by the way, I noticed up there a while ago, B2 Basic said that four of the vendors that were coming down have backed out because hunting season was on. I have two things to say to that. Number one, they knew damn well hunting season was coming on when they made the commitment to come down there. The season hasn't changed since June. Number two, maybe they need the meat. I don't know if they're going for recreation or for because they need to. But my priorities are a little bit different than that. It's and this is the problem. This is the reason that my classes and, you know, all this stuff, we always make people pay in advance because there always seems to be something that comes up before, you know, they say, oh, yeah, I'll be there. You betcha. I'm in like Flint. You couldn't drag me away with a team of horses. And then they have to clean the garage, you know, the last day before they go. So that's why we started making people pay in advance. And you know, once you pay, then that's the end of that. So that's very disappointing because that's, you know, we're having a hard time getting enough vendors as it is. And we made some contacts today, and I think we'll be okay. But those four backing out sure didn't help anything. But that's okay. We'll file that put that in a file somewhere. Okay. Now then, I was going to talk about routes a while ago, but I think I won't now. But what I do think I'll talk about is I've got a couple of stories here. I'm going to talk about one of them for a few minutes. And then we're going to talk about guns a little bit. And then we're going to talk about the other one. Hopefully we can keep everybody interested for a little bit. We're not going to do the any doom and gloom tonight. There's just so damn much of it that sometime we're going to have to take a little break here and there to do other stuff. So I've got to, if this thing will hurry up, my internet seems, there it goes. There's several other really good stories here, but these two here, like I said, I told you last night, I probably should save them for Veterans Day, but I just can't wait that long. So, this is a story about a surgeon. Some of you may have heard about him. He made quite a name for himself during World War II. And I think this was on, forgot which, where it was at here. But anyway, I'm just going to read this. I'm not going to put too much of my own commentary. Well, yeah, I will. I'll throw in a little thing here and there. But it's relatively long, but I think you'll find it extremely interesting and immensely inspiring. These are men, this is back, and I've talked about this before, when men would lie about their age, lie about their family, size, condition, whatever, in order to go and fight for their country. they would sneak aboard ships and planes and do whatever they had to do to get into the fighting. That was the norm, not the exception. Nowadays, people will lie about anything, falsify records, do whatever they need to do to keep from going and fighting for their country, regardless of whether the fight is what we consider justified. There have been few wars, actually, that were really that weren't orchestrated and for some gain or another on one side or the other. So anyway, let's. I'm just going to read this to you. It was at 5 o'clock in the morning on July 7th, 1944. A 30-year-old Jewish dentist from Milwaukee headbutted a Japanese infantry straight and then killed him with the knife he'd taken off of another soldier he'd just killed 2 seconds earlier. All around him, the surgical tent of the 105th Infantry Regiment was in chaos. Wounded men were scrambling to their feet, nurses were urgently barking orders to troops, and the sounds of heavy machine gun fire and rifle fire ripped through the jungle from every direction. But Captain Benjamin L. Solomon had officially morphed from a mild-mannered surgeon to an utterly unstoppable one-man firing squad. Surrounded by the bodies of nearly a dozen enemy troops who had dared to threaten the lives of his patients, Solomon grabbed a fresh rifle off of a table, fixed a bayonet on the end, slammed a clip into the breech, and rushed out of the tent. His final order before racing into the frantic sounds of gunfire was to tell the wounded to get the fallback position ASAP. He'd cover their retreat himself, one man against a battalion of Japanese Imperial Infantry, and buy his patients as much time as he could. Captain Solomon knew the odds for his survival were not good, but he was a soldier, and it was his job to protect his comrades. If he could save just a few men with his actions, he was going to go out without hesitation and never regret it for a second. Benjamin L. Solomon graduated dental school at USC in 1937. He was an Eagle Scout, had an iron constitution, and could run for days without tiring. When he drafted into the U.S. Army in 1940, he left his private dentistry business, rated expert marksman during rifle and pistol qualification, and was declared the best all-round soldier in the 102nd Infantry Regiment, according to his commanding officer. By the time World War II actually started for the U.S. at the end of 1941, Solomon was a sergeant in command of a machine gun section. He was given a promotion to first lieutenant and issued a transfer to the dental corps in 1942, meaning basically that after two years hiatus, this guy could now finally get back to being a practicing dentist again. Except Ben Solomon didn't want to go back to being a practicing dentist. He wanted to fight the enemy face to face. He declined the transfer. Even after being appointed dental officer in the 105th Infantry Regiment, Solomon still went on to the unit's runs and hikes and routinely won regimental physical fitness competitions, even though he was a doctor competing against frontline infantrymen. The 105th saw its first combat in June 1944 when they landed on the island of Saipan in the Marianas. The troops immediately found themselves in some of the most intense, up-close, and downright horrible, brutal fighting witnessed on any front of World War II, battling an ultra-intense, take-no-prisoners enemy that was absolutely determined to make the American pay in blood for every inch of ground that they gained. Together with the 4th Marine Division, the soldiers of the U.S. Army 27th Division brutally clawed their way off the beaches of Saipan, but the fighting was so intense that they lost half their men, killed or wounded, in the first few days of the battle. Ben Solomon wasn't exactly thrilled to be stuck in a medical tent hoping someone needed their wisdom teeth extracted while his fellow soldiers were out there fighting and dying. So, with his buddies out there engaged in mortal hand-to-hand combat with a brutal enemy, he offered to transfer to surgical service and help fix up the wounded. Captain Solomon was granted his request, and the good doctor was sent ashore to work at a military emergency surgery field hospital just 50 yards behind the front line entrenchments. With machine gun fire ripping up the jungle less than a football field beyond him, Solomon worked tirelessly night and day to triage severely wounded men, reattach limbs, clamp down bleeding arteries, and set broken bones. It was bloody, precise, life-saving work, and it was all done while enemy bullets whizzed through the tent, attack aircraft screamed overhead, and naval artillery barrages shook the earth beneath him. The Americans had suffered horrifically on Saipan, but the battle was going even worse for the Japanese. The Imperial Japanese Army's 43rd Division landed on the island 3 months ago with 30,000 men, but by July 6, 1944, only 5,000 remained. Those that were left were starving, exhausted, wounded, low on supplies, and running short of ammo. But these warriors knew that a U.S. airstrip on Saipan Island would give the Americans direct bomber access to the Japanese home islands, and every single survivor of the 43rd Division would have gladly sacrificed their lives to prevent that from happening. Each man was prepared to stare death in the face and fight to the end, no matter what. That night, the order came down from General Saito Yoshitsugu, I think, to the 43rd Division. We will advance to attack the American forces, and we will all die an honorable death. Each man will kill 10 Americans. Flares lit the night sky at 0500 hours on the 6th of July, 1944, followed immediately by determined screams and the thumping of weapons fire. Mortars rained down all across the U.S. lines as an almost endless wave of enemies a mile wide came charging out through the brush, bayonets held high in a final suicide charge, teeth first into the suddenly badly outnumbered 105th Infantry Regiment. The Americans returned fire, sweeping the field with murderous storms of bullets, but the Japanese attack pressed on relentlessly. Grenades flying in every direction, explosions and sounds rocking the battlefield in seemingly every direction at once. In his medical tent, Ben Solomon worked feverishly. No sooner did he stop one guy from bleeding than another, even more badly injured man, rolled up on a gurney needing immediate attention. Despite taking insane numbers of casualties, the Japanese attack finally reached U.S. trenches, and swarms of soldiers dove in, bayonets at the ready. Solomon, just 50 yards behind the U.S. machine gun nest, reached over for a scalpel and looked up in time to see a Japanese Imperial Army soldier storm through the tent flap and immediately bayonet an unarmed, wounded American soldier as he lay on a stretcher. Ben Solomon instinctively grabbed an M1 carbine off a nearby table, crouched, and fired. The Japanese soldier was dead before he hit the ground. When Solomon was first nominated for the Medal of Honor, there was a lot of debate because the Geneva Convention states that no medical officer wearing a Red Cross armband is allowed to bear arms in combat. The enemy was swarming through the base, and it was total kill or be killed time. Solomon turned back to the operating table, only to see two more Japanese troops bust into the tent, guns at the ready. They were so close that Solomon just swung his rifle like a baseball bat, clubbing the first Japanese soldier and jamming the butt of the rifle into the second soldier's stomach with lightning speed, then killing the first guy with a bullet and the second with a bayonet. But that wasn't it. Four more of the enemy were crawling under the tent from the sides, two on each side, in an effort to flank the dentist and catch him by surprise. One of the Japanese soldiers had a knife in his hand, so Solomon ran over, kicked it out of the Japanese soldier's hand before he could get to his feet. Solomon sighted his rifle and fired, killing the attacker, and by the time he heard the distinctive ping of an empty clip ejecting out of the the M1 Garand, he was already in full rage mode, and something lame like not having bullets wasn't going to stop him. Solomon bayoneted one soldier, dropped the rifle, picked up that knife, spun to face the other two infantrymen who were rushing in on him. Solomon killed one with a knife, headbutted the other, staggering him back, and he was shot and killed by one of Solomon's patients, who finally managed to dig out his .45 pistol. At that point, a radio transmission came in to fall back and regroup in the village that was a few hundred yards up the hill. Solomon grabbed a fresh rifle and told the guys in the tent to get on their feet and bust ass back there. Most of them were badly wounded and needed extra time to get to safety, and Captain Ben Solomon was going to give it to them. He pulled back the slide, loaded a round in the chamber of his rifle, and rushed through the tent flap. Most of the 30-plus men in the hospital were able to get out with their lives. When the last orderly left the hospital tent, he looked back over his shoulder to see Captain Benjamin Solomon single-handedly manning a heavy belt-fed 30-caliber machine gun, spraying fire in sweeping arcs while enemy troops swarmed him from every direction. On the afternoon of July 8, 1944, the United States Army retook the positions along the beach, finally sweeping aside the last remnants of the defending Japanese force on Saipan Island. When Captain Edward Love surveyed the scene after the battle, he discovered Captain Benjamin L. Solomon's body slumped over his machine gun. He counted 98 dead enemy soldiers sprawled out before him. Looking at the scene, it was clear that Solomon had single-handedly repositioned the incredibly heavy 30-caliber machine gun four separate times, each move being required because the enemy dead had piled up so high in front of him that he couldn't get a clear line of fire through the stack of corpses. He did this despite being wounded no fewer than 24 times by enemy bullets, bayonets, and enemy shrapnel. Captain Ben L. Solomon killed more than 100 enemy soldiers, not because he loved death, but because he loved killing, or because he hated Japanese people or held some weird personal grudge against any man on the other side of his gun barrel. He did this because he was a soldier, and this is what soldiers do. They routinely put their lives on the line for their friends, their country, and their beliefs, and they will do it willingly and without hesitation. Captain Benjamin L. Solomon was nominated for the Medal of Honor on five occasions for his actions on the beaches of Saipan. In 2002, he became just the third Jewish soldier from World War II to receive the United States' highest award for heroism in battle. That was the... Let's see, hang on just a second here. I think that was it. Oh, here, let's read the, certificate here. Captain Ben L. Solomon, United States Army, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty. Captain Ben L. Solomon was serving at Saipan in the Marianas Islands, July 7th, 1944, as a surgeon in the 2nd Battalion. He was attacked by an overwhelming estimated force between 3,000 and 5,000 Japanese soldiers, one of the largest attacks in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Although both units fought furiously, the enemy soon penetrated the battalion's combined perimeter and inflicted overwhelming casualties. In the first minutes of the attack, approximately 30 wounded soldiers walked, crawled, or were carried into Captain Solomon's aid station, and the small tent soon filled with wounded men. As the perimeter began to be overrun, it became increasingly difficult for Captain Solomon to work on the wounded. He then saw a Japanese soldier bayoneting one of the wounded soldiers lying near the tent. Firing from a squatting position, Captain Solomon quickly killed the enemy soldier. Then as he turned his back to the wounded, two more Japanese soldiers appeared. This is all the same. It's just in a little different words. It's the same thing. Being told again, Captain Solomon's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States Army. So, there you go. There are still a few men and women, by the way, there are still a few men and women out there that are built out of the same kind of stuff there, but not nearly as many as there was back in the day. And for someone to to dive into this as selflessly and unhesitatingly as he did is certainly a rare breed, no doubt about it. So. All right. Now, when we when we come back from the break, I got a couple of gun things I want to talk about from one gun thing. And then I have another similar story about another guy that I want to get to. And we'll get to that here in just a minute. So hang out with me here just a minute and I'll be back.
No, I got it. Come and get it. Who's your daddy? Who's your baby? Who's your buddy? Who's your friend? And who's the one guy that you come running to when your little life starts tumbling? Your things and go. Just how much will be lost, nobody knows. Mama grabbed the Bible and the pictures off the wall. She packed the car with memories but could not fit them all. And I could still see her troubled eyes while she tried to decide what she would take with her and what to leave behind. The man said, fly, fly, the devil's inside, the rodeo and the cheddar sky, fires that burn out of control. God bless those left behind to fight the flames and hold the line and give it all to save our home from the fire on the rodeo. We watch the news every day from the shelter at 5 o'clock in the 10. And they told us to hang together, we're doing the best we can. Someone said the president's here, but it's hard to get information. Is our home still there or is it gone? The hard part is not knowing. Inside the rodeo and the cheddar sky, fires that burn out of control. God bless those left behind to fight the flames and hold the line and give it all to save our home from the fire on the rodeo.
You fought all the way, Johnny Red. Bring it on. If you're tired of being spoon-fed politically correct Calvin every time you turn the radio on, join Colt Reynolds for The Shooting Bench for the most politically incorrect firearms information program on talk radio.
I heard your teeth chatter from the cold outside. Saw the bullets open up the wounds in your side. I saw the young boys as they began to fall. You had tears in your eyes, cause you couldn't help it all. But you fought all the way, Johnny Reb, Johnny Reb. You fought all the way, Johnny Reb.
The Shooting Bench, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 to midnight Eastern, on the Survival Circle.
Lord, he'd call a great victory ball, but he asked the band to play the song, Dixie, for you, Johnny Reb, and all that you believe, cause you fought all the way, Johnny Reb, Johnny Reb.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
But you can find it right here on the Shooting Bench, coming up next. Coming up already. We haven't been past that point, so let's just carry on here and get this deal over with here. There was a discussion came up today about some gal posted a pair of shorts that she wears to conceal her handgun. And this pair of shorts, they're built very strong elastic pockets in the rear that are supposed to resemble holsters. And it's almost centered on the spine. It's not quite small of the back, but it's real close. And I said in the beginning there, she showed that picture, and evidently the picture wasn't actually her. It was a pretty impressive picture, to tell you the truth. But she said that showing that, I said, well, it's a good looking picture, but it's a very, very poor choice for wearing a gun there. And she immediately got pretty butthurt about it. And it wasn't my intention to do that. It's just to let people know I cannot see something like that and not say something about it, because I know that there's people out there that will look at it and listen to what other people have to say and say, hey, wow, I need to get me one of those. That is way too cool. And, you know, there's nothing cool about wearing your handgun in small of the back. I think that the reason most people do is because of the movies. I really do. There's a lot of things bad. You know, apparently, she took the thread down. I don't even see it here now. So apparently, she nuked it. Somebody else must have got on there. I don't know. Let me try one more thing here, and I'll see if I can dig it up. Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I said, that's a very poor choice. She said, well, being a woman, I strongly disagree, and unless you're a woman, you know, you wouldn't know, or something like that. And I said, well, you know, most of the women that I know have been professionally trained, or that are professional trainers, don't carry that way and don't recommend it. I mean, I posted a quote from the Cornered Cat, which is one of the top women experts in her field, and about small of the back. And so it didn't matter all of the things that I showed her. What mattered was, now she says that she has some physical challenges. She was talking about her hourglass figure and wearing an ostomy. So, you know, I obviously don't know what that is like. But that doesn't change the fact that wearing the gun back there has a lot of challenges, a lot of liabilities. So if there is so you wear an ostomy, that's fine. But there's still other options to be able to carry that that gun. So let's just look at some of the things that there are no upsides to that. There's zero upsides to it. For every upside that you think you can imagine for it, I can probably find two or three or five downsides to it. Some people will say that it's comfortable. I can promise you that it is not comfortable in all aspects of your life all day long and everything that you do. It may be comfortable as long as you're walking down the street and staying upright. It is not comfortable driving a car. It is not comfortable sitting in a closed back chair. It's not particularly comfortable if you have to spend a lot of time bending over. It is not concealable. You have to wear a pretty heavy coat, or you have to remain standing. If you bend over even the slightest, even with a pretty good sized jacket on, it shows. The only person that can't see it is you. It shows bad. Now, being as it rides right on or near the spine, there is a high probability for spinal injuries if you were to get slammed back into, you know, in a scuffle into a brick wall, or land on your back on the street, or, you know, in types of maybe a motorcycle wreck. I mean, there's a lot of different things where you may wind up, you know, fall down the stairs, something like that. Now, the argument can be said that, you know, so I wear it on my hip and that hurts too. Well, the hip is not likely to leave you paralyzed for life. It's not likely to take you out of action instantaneously like spinal injuries will. What if, particularly a woman, but, well, no, particularly nothing, anybody. What if you get in a scuffle with someone that's bigger than you, and you're close to a wall, and so they grab you and shove you back against the wall? Even if you don't get the spinal injuries, how are you going to get to your gun? There's no way with that pressure on you that you can reach behind you and pull that out and get it out of there and fire a close contact shot like you probably would be able to if it was at the 330 position on the hip. When you're wearing a very light shirt, you can bend over a little bit and stand back up, and the shirt will probably hang up on the grip of the gun, which essentially means now that you're open carrying. It also means that someone behind you that you can't see, unless you have eyes in the back of your head, you have just made your gun fully accessible to anybody that's behind you. That wants that gun. So there's a lot of issues with this. Now you can say, well, I take it out when I'm driving. No, that is not an option. You don't take the gun out when you're driving. You find a place where it's comfortable. I wear mine at 3:30 on my right hip all the time. And I can drive, I can ride horses, I can sit in any type of chair, I go whatever, it doesn't matter. I can bend over, I can reach to the side, I can kick to the side. There's a lot of things that other types of holster positions don't give you all that freedom. It takes a little while to learn that and going through all the different things that that you might run into. But small of the back is a Hollywood invention. What about the presentation? How slow is it to draw from behind the back? How long does it take you? There is no position. It's a little better with some of those that are in extreme angle. But there's just no position that is fast. I mean, even a little bit quick. If we look at the average, we're trying to make that shot, that first and hopefully that fight-stopping shot or two, we're hoping to make those in well under 2 seconds. Now, I can pretty well promise you that you're not going to make that shot under 2 seconds. Basically, what we try for is 1.5 seconds, no more than 1.5 seconds from concealment. That's our standard in our more advanced classes for handgun, and that is 2 shots from concealment. My record at this point is, and I know there's a lot of people out there faster than me, that my record is 1.34 seconds for 2 shots from concealment into the kill zone center mass of the target. So that's what we're shooting for, is 1.5 seconds, you know, certainly under 2 seconds somewhere. And that's not going to be happening from small to back. There is no good way to clear that garment for the presentation quickly and get it out of the way. There's no good way to establish a... now, you might with one of the holsters that I say that are at extreme angles. But for the average small to back holster, it is simply nothing more than a place to tote the gun around. It is not built for fighting. Now, to have a small, flat back up there, I could go for that. I would rather have it there than in an ankle holster, I think. I could go for a small, a little 380, or certainly not a revolver, but a small 380 or a little flat 9mm like the Glock 43 or something like that. And I think that would be acceptable. You got to carry a backup somewhere, so that's probably as good a place as any. But certainly not by any remote stretch of the imagination would I put my primary gun there. Actually, if I was going to carry a secondary, it would be, if I was carrying it concealed, it would be inside the pants on the left-hand side in exactly the same place that my primary would be on the right-hand side. That's my first choice, you know, depending on how I'm dressed, what I'm doing, what the mission calls for. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So, anyway... We go through this kind of stuff. And I said, you know, I talked about people that have gotten, or women that have gotten training and trainers and stuff. So she says, as a woman who has both trained and trained others, and I said, okay, here we go. So at that point, I just pretty well let it drop. So. Somebody said, wow, good picture. Those, you look good in those shorts. And she said, well, it wasn't me. That's just my shorts. So I said, well, whoever you loaned your shorts to sure looked pretty good in them anyway. But I don't think that made her very happy. But anyway. And I don't know why she got so upset about it. It was my observation for her post, and that's why you put that stuff up there. If you don't want people to respond to it, then don't put it up there, is the way I feel about it. So, now then, we have another story that is similar to the one we just read. This guy is Sergeant First Class Alwyn C. Cash, United States Army, distinguished himself by exceptional gallantry in action in the face of violence while serving as the platoon sergeant of 1st Platoon Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 15th Infantry Regiment, based at McKenzie, Salah ad-Din Province, Iraq. On 17 October 2005, Sergeant First Class Alwyn Cash's heroic actions saved the lives of 6 of his fellow soldiers. At approximately 19:15 hours, his platoon departed the forward operating base along Route Hymie, I think that is, to conduct a route clearance operation along a supply route that ran through a town adjacent to the post, or the forward operating base it was. After traveling about 4 or 5 kilometers, the lead Bradley fighting vehicle, of which Cash was in the gunner's hatch, struck a vehicle detonated IED and placed across the route. The blast ignited the fuel cell, causing fuel to spew throughout the vehicle, igniting a fire and causing the vehicle to roll to a stop. Also, from the forward left flank of the blast site, the platoon received enemy small arms fire. Soaked with fuel himself, Cash managed to dismount the vehicle and assist the driver, whose uniform was on fire. Cash extinguished the flames on the driver, the six soldiers, and an interpreter were in the troop compartment of the burning vehicle. Flames had engulfed the vehicle and were darting from the weapons ports. One of the soldiers in the back of the vehicle attempted to open the hatch door in an attempt to help the soldiers escape. The flames intensified, and everyone inside was aflame. Without regard for his personal safety, Sergeant First Class Cash rushed to the back of the vehicle, managed to help open the door, and began to pull the soldiers out one at a time. In doing this, the flames totally gripped his fuel-soaked uniform, causing severe, painful burns. Despite this pain, he bravely continued to pull his troops out of the vehicle and feverishly worked to put their flames out. As the chaos continued, Cash noticed that the platoon medic was still inside. He rushed back to the vehicle, reached through the flames, and pulled out the medic, all this despite being on fire himself. Within moments, a trail vehicle arrived and assisted with the case vac. Although severely burned, Cash bravely continued to take control of the situation as best he could. Shortly thereafter, the company's First Sergeant Chris McKenzie, accompanied by medics and other soldiers from the company, arrived and began to evacuate the severely burned soldiers, the worst of which was Sergeant Cash. The forward operating base helipad served as the landing zone for the air evacuation. Badly burned, all six soldiers were alive when they were air evacuated. The interpreter did not survive the blast and was immediately transported to the battalion morgue. Throughout the nightmarish ordeal, 10 soldiers were injured. 6 of the 10 were treated at the Balad Hospital. 5 of those 6, including Sergeant First Class Cash, were later evacuated through Landstuhl to the burn center in San Antonio, Texas. Sadly, over the next 6 weeks, 4 of the 6 died of their wounds. Despite being the most severely injured, with second and third degree burns over 72% of his body, Sergeant First Class Alwyn Cash endured while his soldiers were alive. He suffered through painful surgeries, infections, organ failure, and loss of body parts as he continued to be on the consummate platoon sergeant to his soldiers. Sergeant First Class Alwyn Cash died of his wounds on 8 November 2005. He was the last of those so severely injured that terrible night to die. Sergeant First Class Cash's selfless and gallant actions allowed the loved ones of these brave soldiers to spend precious time by their sides before they succumbed to their dreadful injuries. Although he is no longer with us, Sergeant First Class Alwyn C. Cash is the type of heroes that historians write about. His actions were in keeping with the first traditions of military heroism, reflect greatly upon himself and the United States Army. So there's another one that is very much like the first story. And there are lots of stories like that. There are current stories like that. There are stories dating back, I'm sure all the way back to medieval times as far as that goes. But certainly there's some stories coming out of the Civil War, lots of them out of Vietnam, World War I, World War II, Korea. And now we're getting stories in from the sandbox. So, I don't know how to properly honor these people, all of them that are serving over there, particularly the ones that that throw themselves on grenades and with their uniforms on fire, run into burning vehicles and pull people out and be shot, literally dozens of times. There's a story of one guy that was shot. We heard about the first story. We told that guy had, what would I say, 24 or 27 wounds. Well, there was another one about a guy that fairly recently that got wounded, I think, 27 times, and actually survived in quite a story. David Hackworth, for those of you that David Hackworth is a soldier, great writer, great trainer. He said, if you find yourself in a fair fight, you didn't plan your mission properly. I like that. I'm going to put a deal. Now, there's a book about this guy. Let me see if I can find, see if it's on this deal I'm about to put on here. I don't see it. I may have to go find the book, but I'm going to put this on here for you to look at if you want. If you don't want it, doesn't cost me anything to put it there. Here's the story, and I'm going to go get a link to a book about this guy. If you'll give me just a minute here, I'll get that link, and I think it's one that I might. I think it's one that I might like to read. Let me see if this is the right link here. Okay, let me put this in there and see. No, that's the same one I just put in there. All right, let me see. There's, see if I can find this book here. No, it's not a book. I'm sorry. That's just a blog post. That's part of the blog. Okay, that's it that I just posted. That's all of it. I'm sorry. Okay. All right, there you have it. And this wasn't meant to be a... the heck, what word am I trying to find here? Not meant to be doom and gloom for everybody. It's actually just the opposite. It's meant to let people know that there is hope, that there are good, strong men that have their priorities in order, that miss out on the war because it's hunting season. You know what I mean? So. Anyway, there's still some of them out there, and we appreciate them. We love them. Is there anything we can do for them and their families? We're certainly here. Those are definitely the sheepdogs and part of the 3%. And I'm not, don't think that I'm taking one thing away from every single individual over there that has served honorably. And even if they got away without a scratch and made it back, that it just means that they... the Lord is watching over them. They were lucky at that time. Every single one of them that served honorably, they deserve every bit of honor and everything that we can give them. So let's see. Yeah, Doc, you know, I agree with all that. I agree with everything you're saying there. I really do. And but nevertheless, we can't take away from those that went over there and served and felt that they were doing the right thing, regardless of what the politicians and everybody else did. Those men and women deserve, you know, all the prayers we can muster up for them. B2Basic, sure enough, sorry to hear about your nephew. B2Basic. Nephew burned badly. Fixed an old truck, take his girlfriend out to propose to her, and a kid was dumping fuel in the carburetor, and it backfired and caught the can on fire. You know, that's there's not a time to be saying what could have, should have, and I'm sorry that happened. You know, as youth, We learn as we get older. We learn not to do certain things. Sometimes it's somebody else's expense. Sometimes at our own expense. Sometimes we were lucky and got away and learned before anybody got hurt. But all too often, something like this happens with like B2Basic's nephew there, And, you know, there's always the, I wish I'd have done it different. But that doesn't change the fact that it has already happened. And so B2 Basic prayers up, definitely, and I'll tell Amy about that for your nephew and his family tonight, and for the family of the guy that that threw the trash can, the gas can. I'm sure he was scared and just happened to throw it in that direction, and I'm sure that it was not on purpose, and he needs prayers as much as anybody else does. I'm sure that he doesn't feel good about what happened. So on that cheery note, I think we'll get ready to head on out of here. Everything is a go as far as I know for tomorrow night. Amy is off on Wednesdays, as you all know. I will be in at 8:30. If something changes and I'm able to make it early, I'll try to give everybody plenty of notice. I won't just show up at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock or anybody. I'll try to make sure that I put it in the chat and Facebook, you know, 2 or 3 hours before that if I am able to, so that you all can adjust your schedules if you'd like. So. All right. That's enough of that. So I'm going to get out of here. We'll see you all tomorrow night. Thanks for joining me.
This has been The Shooting Bench with Cope Reynolds of Southwest Shooting Authority.